Hi, welcome back. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. It's great to be with you today. In the next half hour, I'm actually bringing you a recording that is being done on the 29th of April, 2012. I was having trouble getting on to Rochelle McCready during the live broadcast last week, and I had to put in some fill-in material, but I've decided in this section of the show to bring you some fresh news and commentary. Now, there are two main topics I want to cover. First is the ABC Q&A documentary and panel, which was aired last Thursday, and the title of the program was I Can Change Your Mind About Climate. And I was actually in the audience. I was down there at the ABC studios in Ultimo in Sydney, and I sat through the airing of the documentary, and I was in the audience for the panel. And I had several questions prepared that I was hoping to be able to deliver. The way the show works is that when you come on as an audience member, you're asked to prepare questions, but only a small number of those are allowed through. And of course, mine weren't. But anyway, I was there, and it was quite an interesting program. I have a lot of criticisms of it, and I'm going to go through two parts of the show that I'm actually going to analyze and deconstruct. I then want to talk about what's going on in Australian news and politics right now, today, with the announcement of the effective resignation from the ALP of Craig Thompson, the embattled MP, who's been accused of many things, including using government money to pay for prostitutes. And of course, his resignation from the ALP is part of an ongoing saga that the government is having. And it is very critical for their position in power because currently they only are able to govern by a majority of two votes. But we'll go into more depth there in the question of Craig Thompson and, of course, the Speaker of the House, who has also been suspended from his current role. Now, there are two parts of the documentary from the ABC that I'm going to play to you. The first one is the section where they were discussing the atmospheric measurements at Mauna Loa in Hawaii. Now, the atmospheric CO2 measurements are a critical part of the overall case for a dramatic and dangerous increase in CO2 levels on the planet. And the way it is presented on the ABC is certainly very convincing, and if I were to simply view that, believing it, I would be very, you know, much on the side of Anna Rose, and I would say, well, yes, there is a big problem here. So first of all, I'm going to play that to you, then I'm going to provide some of my own analysis of that.
On top of the world's largest volcano, Mauna Loa, this research station is ground zero in the climate debate. This is where it all began. For more than 50 years, scientists here have measured the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And it's what they found that first set the alarm bells ringing. The team here today is led by Observatory Station Chief John Barnes.
What we're doing here is watching Aiden take a flask sample. Mauna Loa is really unique because we're up so high, we're above most of the pollution, local pollution. You can see the cloud layer, and that's really the top of the boundary layer. So most of the pollution, particulates, and water vapor are below us.
This continuous record of CO2 reveals something truly remarkable.
This yearly cycle of the Earth breathing in and breathing out, the biosphere taking in CO2 and then releasing it.
What drives that? What causes that?
Well, in the summertime, your plants are growing and they're taking in carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
And just the reverse happens in winter. You get, they're decomposing and it comes back out. And that's been going on for millions of years.
Sure.
But on top of that natural annual cycle, the data shows a worrying long-term trend.
The thing that was really obvious in just a few years was that the level of CO2 was increasing. Right now, it's about 392, and in a few years, it'll reach 400.
This comes from human burning of fossil fuels?
Yes. We're sure that the increase is due to fossil fuel burning. Yeah. That's the only thing that works, that makes sense.
Ever in history, has the CO2 levels been as high as they are now?
Not in the last million years.
That's really scary to me, this graph. Seeing
it's only 0.03 to 0.04.
It's never
too excited.
But it's never been... Trust me, I'm not excited. I'm actually scared.
I mean, pretty excited.
The fact that it's never been at this level in a million years. And this is the consequences to our actions to burn.
Okay, I'll leave it there. Now, Anna, of course, is very scared because the levels, according to this man she's talking to, have never been higher in a million years. Now, if you actually do some reading and research on the topic of CO2 levels, you'll come up with some interesting, I guess, variations on that point of view. But it's really important to emphasize one thing, which is that the Mauna Loa measurements only began in 1960. That series, that record, starts in 1960. And it's from 1960, it's going straight up. I mean, there's no sort of change. It's from the moment they started measuring it, it was increasing. Now, in terms of like before 1960, there are a variety of other methods for measuring CO2 concentration in the Earth's atmosphere. The one that is the most predominant and the one that has the longest historical record is the Vostok ice cores. Now, when you actually look at the Vostok ice cores, and I've got a PDF file here of a scientific study that shows you the data there from the Vostok ice cores in its raw form. And I do encourage you to have a look at this, and I'll put some of this on the website. When you look at this information that goes back, well, the one I'm looking at here goes back 400,000 years. What you see is a regular rise and fall in CO2 levels. And, of course, we're talking about a much larger time scale here than say, the last, 40 years or whatever that they've been measuring it at Mauna Loa. And it really doesn't represent the information very well if you tried to go into such short time spans. And so one red flag to really raise here at this point is that when the scientist in the video there was saying, well, this is the highest it's been in a million years, he's not using his own records there at Mauna Loa to make that judgment because they only go back to 1960. He's now referring to the other historical records that we've got, such as the Vostok ice cores. But the Vostok ice cores don't have such a fine grain measurement, at least as far as I can tell. And if anyone would like to write in and tell me I'm wrong, you're welcome to do it. But from my understanding here, there is a lack of congruence between looking at, say, the Mauna Loa CO2 concentrations and looking at the vast historical data that is available in the Vostok ice cores. But what we do see in that period is a regular rise and fall. And of course, at the moment, we're in a rise. And if you look at the peak that they've got here for the current period, it's not much greater than the previous ones. We'll be right back after this break to continue. You're with Truth News Radio Australia.
Then it's just like me. I made it to the forward deck. I blessed our remnant fleet and then consented to be wrecked. A thousand kisses deep.
Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, and I'm going through some information from the ABC Q&A show, I Can Change Your Mind About Climate Change. Now, as I was saying, the Vostok ice cores show the pattern over history. And once you start to see the pattern over history, you realise, well, there's been this continuous glaciation and deglaciation, warming, cooling, well, rapid cooling, rapid warming, periods of extreme cold, followed by shorter periods of warmth, followed by periods of extreme cold. And of course, we're currently coming out of one of those periods of extreme cold. So it has been warming, and the CO2 concentrations have been rising during that warming period. And you look at the graphs and you see, well, it's not really that much different. And in fact, the conclusions in this particular paper are that CO2 levels are higher than they've been for the last 400,000 years or so. Other papers that have been written have said they're higher than they've been for 20 million. The scientist in the ABC program said the last million. Well, the point is, they're not different. The pattern is not different to what we've seen. But the pattern is a pattern on a huge timescale that includes massive changes in the Earth's temperature. And we're trying to extract meaning and attribute meaning to measurements over a period of a few decades when the real patterns that we're seeing are so much bigger and they occur over such huge time frames. So there is a deceptive message being put forward when it's expressed in such a way that we're meant to be overly concerned about what we're seeing here at this present point in time. And if I was to look at the real historical reality, what I'd be most concerned about was if we were going into a cooling period. If we were going into one of these glaciation periods, I would be very, very concerned. One other thing to remember is that the last million years have been known geologically as the Ice Age. That whole period of a million years is the Ice Age. So historically, the CO2 levels have been lower throughout that whole period. Now, let's hope that we're not going back into that ice age. Let's hope that that ice age isn't over. And let's hope that the CO2 levels do stay higher, because the CO2 levels being higher and the temperature being warmer has facilitated the flourishing of human civilization. That's my opinion. Now, the next section I'm going to play to you from the ABC documentary is the interview with Richard Muller. And I'll just kick it off and I'll make some comments about it after the end of that.
Theories need to be tested and judged against recorded observations. And one of the main arguments of skeptics like Nick is that the very foundation of global warming, that temperatures are rising, is based on faulty data. Just outside San Francisco at the University of California, Berkeley, we have a surprise for Anna and Nick. A scientist well known for his skeptical views has gone back to check the figures.
The stations that were recording these temperatures, still many of them were right next to buildings or heat sources.
that physicist Richard Muller was so concerned that errors might have corrupted the temperature record that he set up an independent study to reconstruct the last 50 years of climate history.
How about sitting here?
Yeah, good idea.
We looked at the effects of the extra heating that takes place in cities, which is not part of the global warming. We looked at the station quality bias.
We saw this from some people that we visited in Perth.
Yes.
Were showing us that, saying that, you know, the main cause of global warming is air conditioners because they're next to...
Well, I mean, what this shows is that it could be the main cause of global warming. And so these are precisely the things that we studied.
We looked at. Yeah. Yeah.
Does it surprise you where they put a lot of these measuring stations, the fact that they are near all these?
You know, I'll tell you, when people were building these stations 10, 20 years ago, they put them where it was convenient, where they wouldn't have to walk far in the rain to read it.
Right, yeah,
so
sure.
Now we worry about it. Well, let me show you some of the results. I mean, quite frankly, when we got this, I was surprised. The three blue, green, and red curves are what the previous groups had found, and the black one is what we found. And we're getting basically the same result as other people had had. Yes, it's lovable.
Muller's results have shaken the skeptic world. They confirm that the temperature records produced at NASA and in the UK were right all along. Some of the doubts raised by Perth bloggers Joe Nova and David Evans seem to have been answered.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, the doubts raised by Joanne Nova and David Evans have not been answered, and the skeptic community was not shaken to its core by Professor Richard Muller's study. His own conclusions were refuted by Professor Judith Curry, who chairs the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at America's prestigious Georgia Institute of Technology, according to the Daily Mail. Now, who is Professor Judith Curry? Well, she's actually a co-author of the paper. And she was outraged and amazed at the conclusions that he came to. Because all the study actually shows is that global warming has occurred since 1950. And nobody's disputing that. In fact, 1950 is the period when we were in a little bit of a cooling phase. And that's very easy to prove, that we were in a slight cooling phase because it was warmer early in the century. It became cooler around about 1945, 1950, and then it started to warm up. And there has been a warming trend since then. However, the data from this study also shows that warming trend seems to have plateaued from about 1998. Professor Judith Curry says that the conclusions of Professor Richard Muller are a huge mistake with no scientific basis. So when there is a dispute from within the scientific community, from between two authors of the same paper, to claim that this is any kind of amazing trump card of the mainstream warmest viewpoint is just ludicrous. And it's actually an insult. And this is an example of where we really need to go back to the ABC and hold them to their charter, because they are not providing quality research. They are not providing quality information. All this information is going to be linked on our website. I encourage you to check it out. Look at Judith Curry. Read all of the scandal around this. Richard Muller is discredited. It's an outrage that this was put into the ABC documentary without at least a reference to the fact that his own conclusions are disputed by his own colleagues and co-authors. Anyway, there's a lot more that we could go into in relation to that ABC documentary, but we don't really have time. I just want to now turn to the current state of affairs in Australian politics, which things are on a knife edge, folks. We have Craig Thompson, the embattled MP, has now resigned from the ALP and joined the crossbenchers. We have Peter Slipper, the Speaker, who has been suspended pending allegations of misuse of cab charge vouchers and sexual harassment. His suspension is now extended. The Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, went on television today to announce that all of these things had occurred and that she was essentially taking charge and distancing herself from these two individuals. I just want to read to you an analysis I have given. And this is from an article that is published on Truth News Australia. Whether you believe or not in our representative democracy, I hope you can see that we need an election now. And that if this occurs, as it should from the numbers against the government and the scandals over MPs, Abbott must uphold his promise of fully repealing the carbon tax, on pain of creating an even greater popular backlash than we are experiencing now. Thompson's resignation from the ALP is purely for show and has no bearing on his tenure as member for Dobell or on how he will vote in Parliament. It is a further insult to the very concept of democracy that a sitting MP can play with his role in such a manner. This is a fraud against the Australian people. If we believe in democracy at all, we must be prepared to take action to ensure restoration of the basic values of a free society. Otherwise, we will only slip deeper into tyranny. The government, according to current polls, enjoys a 29% popularity rating. They don't have a mandate to govern. Are you prepared to hit the streets to let them know how you feel? We'll be right back after the break with Rochelle McCready. Stay with us.
The man who stole the water will swim forevermore, but he'll never reach the land on that golden shore. That faint white light will haunt his heart till he's old.
Hi, welcome back. You are with Truth News Radio Australia. My name is Hereward Fenton. It's great to be talking to you today from Sydney, Australia. And I now have on the line my guest who I was trying to get on in the previous segment, and I did mistakenly say we were getting Josh Jackson on. Unfortunately, we've had to bump Josh, but we do have Rochelle McCready on the line. Rochelle, are you there?
Yes, hello, Hereward. I'm here.
Rochelle, it is fantastic to have you on the air. You're broadcasting live across the United States, and I'm really looking forward to hearing your latest insights into ACTA, which I, in a hopelessly garbled way, tried to explain earlier, and I forgot even what the letters stand for. Perhaps you can just start by setting us straight there. What does ACTA stand for?
ACTA stands for the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement. ACTA is a treaty. There are two stages to a treaty. The first is signing, which is just a formality, and the second process is ratification. And it's only when a treaty is ratified, if there's any formality required for the latter stage, that it actually becomes law. It becomes binding on the jurisdiction that signed it.
Excellent.
Does that make sense?
That makes a whole lot of sense. And you've done a lot of research, and we've done some detailed interviews with you, and you've actually dug up some more information, which I think you would like to impart to our audience. So please, continue with that.
Yes, Harold, it's my great pleasure to be able to talk to people about this because it's a very grave situation. What's happened is there were two cases before the High Court of Australia. That's, for the benefit of the US listeners, that's the most senior court in the land. It's like the equivalent of the US Supreme Court, that involved very strong statements of principle that went against the spirit of the ACTA agreement. And the first one was the IINet case, and the second one is the National Rugby League and Optus TV Now case. The first one was about whether the IINet case was whether internet service providers are responsible for the online infringement of copyright by their users, and the second one is whether time shifting in the cloud is permitted. Now, the Minister for Broadband and Digital Communications, Stephen Conroy, who can always bank on being on the wrong side of just about any debate, has indicated that in the event that the High Court of Australia went against the spirit of the ACTA agreement, that is, if they found for IINet and found that they weren't responsible for it, the infringement, online infringement of copyright by their subscribers, then he would introduce legislation so that ACTA became binding on the Australian public. Now, the High Court of Australia upheld the decision of the full court of the Federal Court of Australia in the IINet case, but it actually went one step further, and it said that IINet, or internet service providers, are not responsible for the online copyright infringement of their users on the mere say-so of a rights holder. They said what they must do, if any action is to be taken, is they must introduce the sort of evidence that's admissible in interlocutory proceedings, which is fairly onerous. They've got to join all of the dots. So there you are. Stephen Conroy has now got the High Court of Australia has gone against him, so you can bank that what Stephen Conroy will be doing now is leaning on people and breathing down their necks to get the Copyright Act amended so that we can adopt ACTA. Now, we must, something can be done about this, and it's very, very important that we don't just say ACTA's a bad thing. I'll tell you why it's a bad thing in a moment, but something can be done about this. And it's really important that people go to their members of their elected representatives and they adopt a two-prong approach. They must say to them, the ACTA treaty must be rescinded under Article 41. That's the section of the treaty that allows for a country to rescind the agreement. But we must all simultaneously block any attempt to introduce legislation that will make ACTA operant in Australia. And how I suggest people do this is please go to visit their elected representatives. You make an appointment, you go to see them, and if their office says they can't see you, they're too busy, you ask to see someone else because it's feet through the door. And you go in there and you say to them, I will vote against any candidate who supports the introduction of ACTA. I want the treaty rescinded, and I don't want any legislation introduced to make the law and the ACTA treaty binding on the Australian population.
Right.
And so I'm going to tell all of my friends and all of my family what I'm going to do, and I'm going to urge everyone I know to do the same thing. Now, politicians, whatever they are, if they get a sufficient number of visits from their constituents, they will realise that supporting this is political suicide. So we must take back government from people. They get into power and they get the idea that they're there to support the corporations, not the people who voted for them. Yes. And it's time that we pointed out to them that that's not correct and that we don't like it, but we also have to vote with our dollars. Now, what I suggest we do with music and the entertainment and film is that if we like a musician or we like a singer, we say, look, I love your music, but I'm not prepared to buy any of your CDs because you work for a recording company that supports ACTA. and they want to trash our rights. So I'm prepared to buy digital copies of your music online if you're prepared to make them available, but there is no way that I'm going to support a company that supports ACTA.
Can I just interject one thing there, Rochelle? What I would like to know is how you would recommend we address the problem whereby many musicians have certainly been convinced by the PR and the propaganda of the industry that their integrity and their rights are being protected. Because this is actually the way it's sold to copyright holders, to musicians. And I've spoken to many musicians, believe me, and I've tried to often explain my point of view to musicians, and 9 times out of 10, they don't get it. I mean, some musicians do. The majority of them actually are on the side of the music industry, I have to say, in my experience. What's your experience?
Well, I'm going to get to that. Do you want me to deal with that right now? It's just
no, I'd like to address that later.
I can get to it because I've got statistics to rebut it.
All right.
What we must do with films is we must contact the actors on their website and say, we love your films, but you work for a studio that supports ACTA, and ACTA wants to make our rights collateral damage. Now, what you can do, it's not the music industry that's going broke, it's only the recording industry. The record industry is going broke. The reason why the record industry is going broke is because they are not being responsive to consumer demand. What people want is they want to be able to buy individual downloads of songs. They don't want to have to buy a whole CD. The record industry claims that they're being innovative with their offerings, even though consumers keep telling them over and over again, we want one thing, you're offering something different. Their attitude is that consumers can go to hell and they will make available what they feel like making available, and if consumers don't like it, then they can take a flying leap at themselves. Well, you know, the recording industries are going broke, but there are only three now, and it's doubtful that the Sony recording industry, BMA, or forgotten what it is, will last the year because it's already on the ropes. Now, the thing is that, by and large, Harewood, the recording, the entertainment industry has grown. It's grown dramatically. And the data from PricewaterhouseCoopers and iDate shows that from 1998 to 2010, the value of the worldwide entertainment industry grew from $449 billion to $745 billion. That's quite a leap for a market that's supposedly being destroyed by file sharing. Now, there's also a claim that there are massive job losses in the industry. And this is not true either. This doesn't square with reality, because the Bureau of Labor Statistics data shows that from 1998 to 2008, employment in that industry rose by nearly 20%. The recording industry is saying that, you know, they're losing revenue because people are file sharing. Well, they are losing revenue, but it's not because people are file sharing. People engage in file sharing. The main driver of file sharing is a lack of legitimate offerings. Now, the recording industry has been quite persistent in its refusal to cater to niche markets. I mean, I notice this quite a bit because I love opera, and it's very difficult often to get some of the older recordings in opera because they just don't make them available. So they're not catering to consumer demand, but the thing is that this myth doesn't stand up to examination either. The thing is that what's happened is that plenty of artists have been making money over the years without going through the recording industry. And I have a story for you about Jason Parker. Now, Jason Parker did something quite revolutionary.
Rochelle, I'm going to have to interrupt you. Terribly sorry. Yeah. We are going to break. And
That's right.
You can pick up right where you left off at the end of the break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. And I'm talking to Rochelle McCready about ACTA. We'll be right back.
Sick of the lies, deception, spin and half-truths? Well, so are we. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. Tune in every week at truthnews.com.au or subscribe to the podcast with iTunes or your favourite podcatcher.
Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio Australia. It's great to have your company today. My name's Hereward Fenton and I'm talking to Rochelle McCready, who is a lawyer and who is very committed to matters of freedom and liberty on many different topics. One of them today being the ACTA treaty that she is campaigning against, and she's given us a lot of great information. Rochelle, you were going through, an example here. Perhaps you'd like to continue of your case study that you were giving us.
Yeah. So the argument put up by the recording industry is that artists are losing money because of file sharing. And they're saying that you can't compete with free. Now, here's some debunking evidence.
Okay, thanks.
I come from a science background, you see, and I always look for the thing that refutes a position. And anyway, Jason Parker has disproved this theory because he's shown that file sharing does not harm the revenue from music. What he did was he made downloads of his songs available on a pay-what-you-want basis.
Okay.
So in other words, people could pay nothing if they felt so inclined. They could still get his albums.
Sure.
And his sales shot up dramatically. So this is completely the opposite scenario to that the record industry is telling us will happen. Despite the fact that people could download music for free, they still chose to pay. So this demonstrates that it's not the fact that people can download. It's a lack of legitimate offerings that drives people to file sharing. And this is where the record industry is being particularly obtuse. Now, this sort of success story isn't confined to people like Jason Parker, because there's a website called Bandcamp. And Bandcamp lets musicians set up the simple content stores for their works, and also allows for streams, pay what you want, free or conditional downloads. It's not as big as Kickstarter, but the company announced recently that just for the month of December, it helped artists make over $1 million. And perhaps the most interesting statistic of all, is that when people were given the option of paying what they wanted for albums with a suggested price, an impressive 40% of the time, fans are willing to pay more than the suggested price. So this completely debunks it. The motion picture industry reckons it's going broke, but the truth about the motion picture industry is that the total worldwide box office revenue sales increased by 25% from 25.5 billion in 2006 to 31.8 billion in 2010. Now, I'm going to put some more detailed statistical analysis on the website. According to PricewaterhouseCoopers, reports that include movie revenues went beyond the box office ticket sales, and the film industry has grown worldwide by almost 6% over the five-year period from 2005 to 2010. It exceeded approximately $82 billion in value. So that's quite a jump for an industry that claims it's being sent right by piracy. Another interesting statistic is that the adult films are the most prone to being pirated, and yet they're still going strong. Now, other films do deserve to be mentioned because it's not only big Hollywood box office films. There's also the sort of films that were in the Sundance Film Festival. And in 2011, there are over 4,000 entries. And independently financed films are being produced with renewed vigour now that production costs have dropped. Crowdfunding sites like Kickstarter or Pirate My Film have encouraged more and more filmmakers to produce short films in unique ways. It's been alleged that the Australian and other film industries are suffering as a result of file sharing. Now, this is simply not true. Ed Burns was an extremely successful independent filmmaker. He made The Brothers McMullen, which was considered to be his most successful film. It brought in over $10 million and it gave Burns a path to success. Now, he did this without going through the Hollywood studios. And Kevin Smith's film, Red State, which he produced by he actually profited through avoiding the big studios. He was successful in this. And PricewaterhouseCoopers has indicated that the film industry is in a very healthy state despite all these allegations. So even with all these independent films going.
Rochelle, can I play devil's advocate for a moment?
Yeah.
Now, I want to actually address the problem whereby what you're saying is all factually correct, and I've no doubt of its veracity. But getting back to the way it's viewed by many individual struggling musicians and the way it's been sold to them through a very well-structured and well-funded campaign of PR is that they see that the sharing of files and downloading of someone's music in the form of an MP3 file, they have been told that this is theft, right? Despite the fact that all your figures are correct, it still sounds like you're endorsing theft. It sounds like you're saying, well, it's okay that they've stolen all this stuff because they're still making money. But the moral high ground is still being held by the record companies because they're saying you're doing something bad. And so while I think that it's very important that we have people go to their MP and say, you know, we need to change the copyright, not change the copyright laws, and we need to, not bring in these restrictions, we need to win the argument on a philosophical moral ground as well. And I feel that we need a public campaign to explain to people across the board of all strata of society why downloading a shared MP3 file is not theft and it should never be considered theft. Because as long as they keep using those terminologies, criminal terminologies, even if the record company is still making money, it can still be used against us because it's like saying, well, it's endorsing shoplifting, or it's endorsing pickpocketing. Even Inan could say, well, the person's doing okay even though he got his pocket picked. Well, the point is, yeah, we need to explain why it's not pickpocketing, it's not theft, and it's not immoral.
All right, well, I'll tell you now. Theft has a technical meaning in law. There are two elements to theft. One is animus furandi, that's the Latin, that's the state of mind that is necessary to deprive the owner of the property, to permanently deprive the owner of the property of the possession of that property. So you have an intention to permanently deprive that person of the property. The second is asportation, which is the taking and carrying away of the property. Now, neither of those things occur during file sharing. All that the original file still stays with the right holder, but it's just that there is a copy. So it's not theft at all. And they keep pushing this thing, and it's total, complete, and utter lies.
And so if you were talking to a musician who's going to say to you, look, I'm really worried that I spend all this time, writing a song, getting a band together, recording it, doing all the audio engineering, all this work that takes time and effort and money, and I put my stuff up for sale and it gets downloaded and then someone else shares it and then or copies it off the CD and uploads it and then starts sharing it, ruining my investment and giving it away, and I've put all this effort into it. I demand that, action is done to protect my copyright. I've had musicians say this to me.
Well, you see, Jason Parker showed that that's complete rubbish. I mean, what they've got, people have got to do is stop going through the record companies and make digital copies of their work available online so that people can purchase them on an individual song basis. File sharing actually doesn't harm demand for the music. It actually... there's evidence that not only does it not harm, but it actually increases demand, but not by a statistically significant proportion. That's sort of a something in, I might just briefly explain that in statistics, if something is statistically significant, it means it's greater than the increase that or decrease that could have occurred due to chance. So we've got that. But there's a very interesting thing with films, Herald. And that is that free viewability of films, and it doesn't decrease the demand. Yeah. Research shows that when a film airs for free on television, it actually increases the demand for that film, both in terms of DVD sales and via file sharing. And on top of this, the greater the demand for the content and file sharing, it doesn't appear to harm the sale of DVDs at all. So the thing is that basically file sharing is driven by a lack of available content. That's the thing. It's simply because the record companies are not making available to consumers what consumers want. There's further evidence that when television programs are put on Hulu, that's the site where viewers can download and watch television programs, the demand for file sharing actually decreased in response. Another interesting thing is that the free availability of these programs didn't, contrary to popular belief, decrease the demand for DVDs of these programs. So what's happening here is that we've got the film industry and the record industry going cap in hand to government saying, we want to support an out-of-date business model, and because we're not prepared to be responsive to consumer demand, what we want you to do is to make criminals out of everyone.
Mm.
On our mere say-so. Now, the most abhorrent thing about ACTA is that it reverses the onus of proof. In criminal matters, a person is innocent until proven guilty beyond reasonable doubt, and that is the way things work in common law jurisdictions. Australia is a common law jurisdiction, and the United States and America are common law. But you see, what ACTA does is it says, well, you're guilty because somebody says you are. And what can happen is if you're accused of file sharing or copyright infringement, the police can turn up with a warrant, seize every computer in the house, every external drive, every thumb drive, every smartphone. Then they can seize your paper documents, they can freeze your bank accounts, destroy your business, throw you in jail and say, now prove you're not guilty. And this is something that people must stab out. And I had somebody say to me during the week, look, what we should be doing is just getting a big petition together, not bothering about going to visit the MPs. And I said, well, you obviously weren't looking. I said, GetUp had a huge petition against internet censorship with Stephen. And I said, it did not stop Stephen Conroy, but it didn't even slow him down. If my memory serves me correctly, I think there are about 500,000 signatures on that petition, and Conroy didn't take any notice at all. He's still hell-bent on censoring and sort of going ahead with this sort of stuff.
Rochelle, we've got about 20 seconds left. We're just finishing up. Yeah, any closing statement?
Well, you must. It's time to take back government, and I'll put the relevant statistics on the website so that you can arm yourself with these facts when you go to see your elected representatives. But please do it before it's too late.
Okay, we'll have to cut you off. Sorry about that. We're going off air. It's been great talking to you. See you next week.
Right. Pleasure's all mine, Harold. Thank you very much.
If you would like to support Truth News Australia, here's something you can do right now. Go to our Facebook page, and you can find that by going to the website and then clicking on the Facebook link. If you're not already a fan of our Facebook page, click on the like button. Then invite all your friends to become fans, and you can do that by clicking on the link on the right-hand side that says Invite Friends.